It's Wednesday, December the 1st, and you're very welcome to the Inside Politics podcast from the Irish Times. I'm Hugh Linehan. In the history of the independent Irish state, one figure bestrides the latter decades of the 20th century, and he still casts a long shadow. Charles J. Haughey was a member of Dáil Éireann for 35 years. He was elected Taoiseach four times. But those bare facts fail to convey the many ways in which his unique personality and the way in which he conducted his political and personal life occupied the popular imagination and in many ways shaped the country we still live in today. A major new biography of Haughey is published this week, and I'm delighted to welcome its author, Gary Murphy, Professor of Political Science at Dublin City University. Hello, Gary.
Hi, Hugh. Thanks for having me.
No, it's a pleasure to have you because it's a really fantastic read. It's a hugely substantial piece of work. And I must say that coming to it, I was struck by how much Haughey has been reduced in the popular culture these days to a very few simple caricatures on that clip on Reeling in the Years about us living beyond our means, or the Mara gags on Scrap Saturday, which still crop up in audio, even Martin Turner's cartoons. Because it's nearly three decades now since Haughey left public office. So I'd say for most people, he's just a memory refracted through stories told by old people like myself. So I'd be very interested to know what people who don't remember him think of him, if they think of him at all. What place do you think Haughey occupies in the popular imagination there?
Well, in the popular imagination of my students, I think in DCU, not a lot. I teach modern Irish politics, as you know, and when I was working on this biography over the last, well, too long now, 7 or 8 years, I used periodically ask my students about Haughey, and you know, there was some of the money, and then there was some would say, wasn't there something about sex and extramarital sex and an affair? And then some of them, of course, who would be more perhaps politically aware, would talk about the great days of Fianna Fáil in comparison to the struggles the party certainly have now under the current Taoiseach, Micheál Martin, who, of course, served with Haughey. He was first elected in 1989, as you know. So I think... As time moves on, he fades into the distance. But certainly the legacy, which is obviously complex, as I describe in the book, and contested, is still important. I think it's important in relation to the economy and to the role of the state. It's important in relation to Northern Ireland and the continuing difficulties that have been sort of embellished with Brexit. And it's important in relation to money and politics. I was involved in a different life in terms of looking at things like the regulation of lobbying and whatnot. And certainly the access that certain people had to Haughey, which is now gone, well, at least we think of, I think it is gone, to be fair. I think modern Irish politics is much cleaner. It's much more robust in the architecture it's put in place. I think that legacy of Haughey still lives on as well.
I want to turn to some of those things in a little while, but maybe we could start at the beginning. And one of the things reading, particularly the early chapters, they caused me, I go out for a walk every morning and I live on the north side of Dublin. So I deliberately walked past the house that he didn't grow up his full childhood in, but in his later childhood when he was going to school in Marino and in Fairview, he lived there in Belton Park Road in Dunnycarney. And then I walked up and around by Marino and the modest semi-detached house that he moved into when he got married first to Maureen Lamass. I didn't make it up to Grange Moor, which was the first big house he built, which ended up getting rezoned and made him his first big private profit and still controversial. But just walking those streets and thinking about Haughey while in the midst of reading your book, one of the things about it is that it's a story about a subject which is often under-described in Irish political analysis, which is a story of social class and social class divisions.
Yeah, I think Irish history would be done a good service by someone if they did write a history of class. We're kind of unique, really, in modern Europe without having a definitive history of class. Am I right in myself? But it certainly looms very large in the Haughey experience. I had a very interesting Twitter conversation on Sunday with my DCU colleague Ruth McManus, who's written about inner city Dublin. I think you mentioned her book, Hugh, in one of your Irish Times columns recently. And we were joking about whether Belton Park was middle class or working class. Ruth pointing out that the developer was selling the homes in the 1930s as Paddy Belton, who's got a very good Dictionary of Irish Biography entry for him. But he was selling them as definitely a step up from the corporation houses next door. And I was making the point in my book, though, that there's really, as far as I could tell, no private-public demarcation amongst the people who live there. And if certain people kind of joined in on that Twitter conversation, some saying that Wilton Park was different and some saying, no, it wasn't. And from my perspective, the people who lived there saw themselves, I think, as working class, but had aspirations, you know, as many working class people do. And certainly for their children. I mean, I'm from inner city Cork. Neither of my parents went to secondary school. And I think I would have to describe myself as very middle class now. I live in the suburbs of Castleknock, and I'm a professor in the university, very well paid professor at that. So, you know, class moves, as we know. But certainly the upbringing for Haughey was important in forming much of his views, I think. I write about the father's sickness. So what happened to Johnny Haughey? He was, to use the phrase in use at the time, invalided out of the army in 1928, having served in the War of Independence. Then he took the pro-treaty side. He was a Collins man. There was a picture of Collins in the house. I relay an anecdote that Maureen Lamass mentioned to her father about the picture of Collins, and he said, you know, fair enough. This is Sean Lamass, said fair enough to his daughter. But yeah, and if you look at sort of Belton Park now, I mean, the Haughey family sold that house only in the last few years. Sarah McWilliams, Sarah Haughey, the Charles Haughey's mother, she lived there until she died in 1989. You know, she was get the bus into town. I point that out in relation to his idea of free travel. But it did have a big impact on how he saw himself. And, you know, he wanted to get out of the poverty that he grew up with. I mean, sometimes when I talk to people, they, you know, I remember having a conversation at a talk I gave in Trinity a few years ago during the writing of this book, where, again, the former Irish Times journalist, distinguished commentator Déaglán de Bradoun, told me that, you know, the idea of how he'd been working class is, you know, ridiculous. He used to call himself, used to talk about how his father was an army officer. But later in life, how he did, you know, and it's in the Seven Ages documentary, the great piece of work by Sean O'Morda, that he describes himself as growing up working class. So I think there are complexities and ambiguities there. But, you know, I think how he grew up in, no, I don't think, I know. They grew up in pretty constrained circumstances. I write in the book how Owen Haughey, who was the second person I ever interviewed when I started out on this task, he the Oblate father in Inchicore, he was born 9 years after Charles Haughey. He was the youngest of the Haugheys, and he never saw his father walk. They used to have to carry him up the stairs, up and down the stairs. The boy, Sean, Jock, Charles, as cockle as he was, and Owen were strong enough. And his mother was quite a strong physical woman, but it was hard labour moving, having to live with the what was a very debilitating illness in the family home. Yeah,
and there were limited opportunities for people to move up the social ladder, I suppose, in the Ireland of the 1930s, 1940s, and 1950s, which was characterised for much of that time, by economic depression and mass emigration, no free secondary school education. So if you came from a poor family, there was really only one way out. If you were a bright kid, you might have a chance of a scholarship. And there was a system in place, largely run between Dublin Corporation, as it was at the time, and the Christian Brothers, to select smart boys. It was usually boys at that point. And Charlie Haughey was definitely one of the smart boys, wasn't he?
He was. There's a picture in the book. It's taken from the front page of the Irish Press in August of 1938 of Haughey coming first of 500 students who took what was essentially a scholarship exam for Dublin Corporation, which allowed him to go to St. Joseph's, Joey's in Fairview. His brother Sean had come second in the same exam the previous year. And who became a distinguished civil servant. He was, I think, ended up as the assistant manager in Dublin Corporation. And that was the route, certainly, into success, economic success, or moving up, as you say, the classes for for the Haughies and for Cottle Haughie as he was. He was clearly very smart. You don't come first of 500 if you're not. And he did have a very distinguished secondary schooling. He had then thought about leaving, not taking the leaving cert and leaving and going into either work or into the army following his father. But his mother had a very big impact on persuading him to do the leaving cert. I mean, even in St. Joey, or even in Joey's, the leaving cert is not offered until, I think, 1941. And Haughie takes the leaving cert in 1943. So if even taking the leaving cert was something new for those scholarship boys, many of them would have ended at the, I was in the inter-cert, the group cert before that. And the school itself doesn't begin offering the leaving cert again, I think, just a couple of years before Haughie took it. It was a very famous and distinguished school. It was very good at sport, and Haughie's sport was an important part of the young Cottle Haughie's life. He was clearly, again, an accomplished Gaelic footballer and hurler. The school wins his primary school wins the 1937 Dublin title in hurling and football. And in secondary school, St. Joey's does very well, losing both Leinster football and hurling titles in his last year in 1943. Played in Croke Park for the Dublin minor hurlers. He played on the same day as Jack Lynch played for Cork in the senior final. How he played for Dublin in the Leinster final of the previous year, which had been cancelled because of the emergency, because of World War II. So Haughie and Lynch shared the same field a couple of hours later in 43. So in one way, it was quite a typical childhood. I mean, I did have a significant investigation. I quote a letter from Vincent Brown right at the beginning of the book about, you know, a serious incident in Haughie's childhood. I could find no real evidence of that, but there is evidence of poverty, but there's also evidence of an enlightened, I think, mother, difficult circumstances with the sick father, but schooling being a way to advance. And then the big decision was taken to go to UCD again on a scholarship to study commerce. And in those days, unlike now, and what we would have been used to, Hugh, when we went to college, you kind of chose on the day, and how he chose commerce at the urging of his great friend Harry Boland. Of course, Harry Boland's brother had an accountancy firm and offered Haughie a few years later the position of article clerk, where he begins his sort of route into the Dublin, a different type of Dublin society, I suppose one might say.
Indeed. So he's a dashing young fella from humble origins, but he's a sort of a golden boy. And his rise is, I don't know if it's meteoric, but it's pretty fast, really, given where he came from. He's there's an incident at UCD, which has been much remarked upon over the years, at the end of the Second World War, where there's a disturbance, a scuffle, maybe a riot between Trinity students who had been flying the Union Jack and arguably insulting the Irish tricolour. And Haughie is part of a pack of some UCD students who took umbrage at this, although others, including Garth Fitzgerald, didn't seem to.
Yeah, I mean, it's a very famous story, and I kind of came to it with a bit of fresh eyes. There's nothing really in the archive about it. There's one reference to dining out on that Trinity incident where he writes to Micheál MacLiamore years later. He certainly was involved in an incident. There was, I think, probably drink taking, certainly. He was involved in, I'm not quite a riot, but certainly scuffles with students from Trinity and maybe some UCD supporting students of the Allies. I make the point in the book, I don't think there's anything pro-German or pro-Nazi in Haughie's outlook, but there's certainly a republicanism there from that time.
Although Garth Fitzgerald referred to him as pro-German when asked about this incident at one point, didn't he?
He did, yeah. So if you look at the Mint Productions, Steve Carson, Miriam McCallaghan, production, I think, of 2005. Gary Fitzgerald is quoted at some length about how his career, I think across all four episodes, but makes the point that, you know, he was for the Allies, how he was for the Germans, he went out with girls, how he went out with boys during their UCD time. Maureen Lemass told me that how he had loads of girlfriends, friends who were girls, that might be a better way of putting it, and they began courting, to use that phrase, in their, I think, second year in UCD. But he certainly was involved in an incident, but I think it's just been overplayed very strongly in the sort of the Haughey myth. He might have added a bit to that himself. And there had been clashes between Trinity and UCD students going back a decade or so over Irish republicanism, really. And I think he's just caught up in that in 1945 on VE Day. But, you know, many of us have been involved in sort of hijinks at university, and this one just, I think, got overplayed because of the history of the of one of the protagonists later on.
So he leaves college and he sets up an accountancy firm with his pal, Harry Boland, who you mentioned. And he starts getting into politics and getting involved in Fianna Fáil politics. And he does a lot of work for Fianna Fáil, and he stands on several occasions for Fianna Fáil in successive elections, not very successfully for 10 years or so until he's finally elected in 1957. But he obviously has the close connection with Sean Lamass, who will in due course become leader of the party and Taoiseach. And so he becomes a sort of significant political figure behind the scenes before he becomes a public figure. Would that be fair?
Yeah, that would be very fair. So 1948 election, the first time Fianna Fáil are put out of office since 1932 is the first election Haughey has any input in. He's a volunteer for Fianna Fáil in Dublin North East, I suppose we would call it. And now he's persuaded by Harry Boland, but also by George Colley. Colley and Haughey relatively friendly in the early part of their young adulthood. That sours for a variety of reasons, which we can talk about later on. But he gets involved in that. So he volunteers in 48. And then he joins the Cumann and makes, and if not quite devotes his life, certainly devotes a significant amount of time to politics and to Fianna Fáil in the early 1950s. But he's certainly he's no overnight success. He loses. He loses in 51, he loses in 54. When I say he loses, he's not elected in either of those general elections. He also loses his Dublin Corporation seat. Now, you know, it's one thing to lose a general election, but to lose a Dublin Corporation seat is really, you know, not very good for a person who has certainly had national ambitions from a young age. He then loses a by-election in 56 to the son of Alfie Byrne, the famous Dublin Lord, Lord Mayor, who died, and then Haughey loses that. But the important point is he's the candidate, I think, is the key point there, rather than the fact that he's defeated.
And to some extent as well, he's sort of waiting, isn't he? Because he's trying to make his mark. But there's the revolutionary generation are now into their 60s, or maybe in some cases their 70s. So the clock is ticking on them, and those opportunities are there for him and a new generation of potential leaders of the party.
Yeah, including people like George Colley and others, Harry Boland. But the by election, it's an important by election because by making him the candidate, it gives Fianna Fáil voters who would otherwise have voted perhaps for Oscar Traynor or Harry Colley or some of the other Fianna Fáil candidates, they're voting for Haughey only in 56. So then that gives him a big boost, I think, for 57. So there is this idea of Haughey marrying Maureen Lemass as a kind of a step in his advancement in Fianna Fáil. I don't give that much credence, as you know, in the book, because I think it denies her any agency or little agency. I met her once in 2014. In the company of her son, Sean Haughey. I went out to Baskin Lane to interview her in her house. Now, at that age, she was in her late 80s then. She died in 2017, but she was a relatively formidable woman even then, I thought. And I think the idea that someone married her for their own advancement really is... I don't give it too much credence. I think she was a strong...
But on the other hand, it didn't do him any harm either.
No, it did him no harm whatsoever. And in that by-election, the fact that he was the candidate, I think probably made him in 57, because if he had lost in 57, you know, I mean, Fianna Fáil are tolerant, but they're not that tolerant. I mean, I can't imagine they would have given a candidate who had lost four elections for the Dáil yet another chance. But of course, once he was in, he topped the poll in every single election until his last one in 1989. But certainly, being Lamass's son-in-law, when Lamass takes over the party in 59 or becomes leader and Taoiseach, but even before that, it's important because, I mean, there's a lot of talk about Haughey driving around the country in the 1970s, but he did it in the 1950s, which is less well known. I chart this in my book. He got into a car and he drove in all weathers to Cork, Donegal, and we're not just talking Cork City, like Wicklestone, you know, bad roads, and we're not talking the motorways we have. And now, on his own, with young children who he would, you know, happily have left with Maureen. And he was, I think he's what we would call now an organiser. And he wrote detailed reports, which were sent back to Fianna Fáil head office. Some of them are now, many of them are in the Fianna Fáil archives in UCD, and some of them are in the Haughey archive in DCU. But it certainly did him no harm, or that is very true. And Lamass did come to rely on him as someone he could trust. And the reports are interesting. They're not whitewashes. Some of them are very critical of Cumann, and some of them are very praiseworthy of Cumann. So it's and the Fianna Fáil then, certainly the 1950s, is different to the Fianna Fáil now. For many of its members, it was a social outlet. You know, they would go to Cumann meetings maybe sometimes twice a week, and they would go for a few pints afterwards. But that was an important part of his. I think of his development in Fianna Fáil, yeah.
Both as a figure within Fianna Fáil and also his understanding, very deep understanding probably of the way the party actually worked at grassroots level. And the other thing is that he doesn't just have a familial relationship with Sean Lamass. They're on the same side of an internal argument in the party, which ultimately is won by Lamass when Lamass finally becomes Taoiseach, which is to move away from the disastrous protectionist policies of the preceding 20 or 30 years and towards a more open economy and the beginnings of the encouragement of foreign direct investment and other things we're familiar with now. But he wasn't liked, was he, by some of those elder statesmen on the other side, the people like Frank Aitken and Sean McEntee? They didn't like the cut of his jib that much.
Not particularly. Certainly in Aitken's case, although there are friendlier letters to McEntee and from McEntee to him, including one, I think, in the 67 budget, where he talks about how his masterly performance both in the Dáil, this is when he's Minister for Finance, both in the Dáil and on RT later on. But back to the sort of, yeah, that joust between McEntee and Lamass, how he was certainly one of the new cadre of young politicians. People like Donal O'Malley and Brian Linehan would have been others. The famous Three Musketeers, but all ministers in the 1960s, all looking at a sort of Fianna Fáil being the engine of Irish economic growth. Free trade is important, and ditching protectionism is important. But what I think Lamass and Haughey both shared was a belief that the state could be an engine of economic growth. I mean, it's very interesting in the 80s when Haughey does finally get his hands on the tiller, and it's disastrous in the early 80s, but he had this very strong view that the state could provide the conditions for private industry and private enterprise. He believed that and then he started mixing in some of those social circles, as we know, in the and Fianna Fáil do develop, you know, TACA in the 1960s, but he...
TACA was the fundraising wing of Fianna Fáil that developed very close links with business and financial interests.
Yeah, in the 1960s, yeah. And they used to have these £100, which is quite a lot of money, plate dinners in the Gresham Hotel and grooms and places like this in the 60s. But so he was important there on that front. But to your point about some of the revolutionary elite not liking him, that is certainly true. I think, you know, he obviously was tremendous self-confidence. all his adult life. In fact, all his childhood as well. He self-confidence wasn't a problem for him. He writes to the General Secretary, the legendary Tommy Mullins, in the 1950s, I think 54 or 55, before he's in the Dáil, saying that he can speak with great authority on commerce, finance, budgetary issues, and is happy to speak anywhere on behalf of the party. Now, he's not even 30 at this stage. He hasn't been elected. In fact, he's lost two general elections, but he's happy to put himself forward. And I think some people, Aiken, McEntee, Jim Ryan, former Minister for Finance from Wexford, the Minister for Finance during the opening up of the economy in the late 1950s, would have seen him as gauche, perhaps, or, you know, a bit flash. You know, he did have expensive tastes even then. He bought, he had an account with bespoke tailors in Dame Street. The offices of Boland, Haughey Boland, were on Dame Street, and they had an account next door. He later said he never wore a mohair suit, that he would have had more taste in that. But the men in the mohair suits became this kind of motif of the 1960s, associated with Haughey, Lenehan, and Donal O'Malley. And I do think that struck a discord with people like Aiken, who would have lived through the privations of the revolutionary era, and would have lived through the grim days of the Anglo-Irish economic war of the 1930s and the troubles in the emergency. And the other point, which I think is worth making, Hugh, is some of them were distrustful of his heritage. Some of them were distrustful of the fact that his father was on the other side in the Civil War, and were distrustful of the fact that he was a Collins man. That was obviously well known.
So I get all that, but I also, the thing that's happening at the same time, and I wonder, was anybody thinking about it at the time, is he moves from that modest house I mentioned on the Howth Road in Raheny to a much grander house further up the road in Raheny, for which he pays £10,000, which is a lot of money in those days. At this point, he is a full-time public servant. He has supposedly, you know, doesn't have a direct involvement in the accountancy firm anymore. And not only that £10,000 property within a decade is rezoned and is sold for a couple of £100,000, which is an really extraordinary sum of money. That's many millions in today's money, with which he buys both a stud and his house in Conseely, his Gandon designed house. He's going to hounds. He's driving around in a
Jaguar.
Jaguar. Excuse me. Very important distinction. You know, does nobody ever ask how he's doing all this stuff on whatever it is, three grand a year?
But some journalists start rooting around in the 1960s, and some in Fianna Fáil do start wondering about it. I quote some letters, I think one famously from Paddy Smith, who again would have been part of that revolutionary elite, who was a minister for agriculture until he resigned in, I think, 64, to be replaced by Haughey, who had been minister for justice. So there are rumours about him. And there is disquiet, certainly, within parts of the Fianna Fáil family. He bats all these away, seeing that these are private matters and that public life is different from his private life. I mean, I draw heavily on Colm Keane's work, your colleague in the Irish Times from a couple of decades ago, when his brilliant book, Haughey's Millions, and then his work his book on the Ansbacher account. I made efforts, as he did and others, in terms of, see, could I find where this money came from? And I couldn't. And, you know, that's just the way it is. But certainly, it did become an issue for, or it was an issue for certain people in Fianna Fáil. Now, for others, Haughey was the great hope in the 1960s. They thought of him, you know, that if he could have the big house, not Kinsealy, which he moves into in 69, but Grangemore, that this was a sign of social mobility, which we talked about earlier, Hugh. £10,000 was a lot of money, and I think they sold it for £258,000, which is a colossal amount of money. And then the the assumption then later on was that Hawley had made various investments, and these investments came good, which allowed him then to buy the stud farm and to develop Kinsealy as he does. You know, he does it up, or he has it done up for him. Puts in a swimming pool, which I noted some of the reviewers in the papers talked about. That's the best investment he ever made on someone else's money. And he started using his checkbook to pay for things. And unlike now, you know, once the check was honoured by the bank, that was it. And that's why he got so upset with the bank when they threatened to take his checkbook off them in the mid-1970s before he's back in cabinet, and said that he could be a very dangerous opponent. And then that's where the big issue around the money comes, because Hawley said once he became a minister that he then handed over all his financial issues to Des Traynor, who had started off life as an article clerk in Hawley Boland. But we do know that certainly Hawley was involved in discussions, negotiations with AIB himself in a decade later. And that is where the big contradiction lies from the off. He starts moving money around. You know, I paint this in the book, and Colm Keane does it in his book a couple of decades ago. You know, he sells bits of land to pay off debts he has, not simply with AIB, but he has debts with some of the other banks as well. And he was basically living this extraordinarily odd life, I would put it. I try to get my head around it, but in some ways I can't. I mean, he was in £600,000 debt, we know, in 1974 when he bought Inis Fickleán. Now, one would say, like, to quote Bertie Ahern, like when he said famously about Hawley, who needs 8 million? Well, one can say, who would buy an island for £25,000 or for any sum when they're in that much eye-watering debt? And that is that's the great contradiction, I think.
I was going to ask you about this stuff later on, but I think we're kind of in this part of it now, so we might as well pursue it. I mean, you say in the book, I was reading David McCullough's review of the book,
yeah.
You say in the book that, I quote, the great advantage the public Hawley held was that he was able to keep the private Hawley out of his decision-making on public policy. And David McCullough says that this seems to be, to David, excessively generous. While Hawley may not have directly done political favours for his benefactors, they did get something extremely valuable for their money, which was access. Isn't that true? And isn't that maybe a picture of the way that, whether you want to use the word corruption or you want to use another word, is the way that those kinds of things work in Ireland? That the quid pro quo is opaque, but it's almost certainly there.
Yeah, so I think David's review is, you know, it's very fair and it's very complimentary, so for the most part. And yeah, and there are quibbles in it. And I think Colm Tobin had a similar point in Saturday's review in the Irish Times, and Alan Shatter to an extent in the Irish Independent review. And yeah, I mean, I don't disagree with any of that. My point I was trying to make, and I was trying to get inside Hawley's head here, and I talked to people, lots of people, about the sort of public and the private Hawley. Charlie McCreevy, I interviewed, and I won't use the words he used to me, but we talked about that, and he said something along the lines of that those who had given money to Hawley, if they asked him for something, he would have told them to, you know, go jump. But the point is I think, well made, that the access it gave people certainly left him exposed to what happened later on, and to allegations ever since, right up to right now, and to the reviews of this book, that he, by taking the money, 8 million, 9 million, I think the Moriarty Tribunal settled on, did leave him open, not to just to allegations, but to the widespread view that he was corrupt. And I think that was a difficulty for him. I tried to follow the evidence as best I can. And certainly, if you look at what happens with beef in the 1980s, we know, for instance, he used Larry Goodman's private jet in 1987. There's a letter from Hawley to Goodman thanking him for the use of that jet. And that did leave him, I think, That was a difficulty for... No, he didn't see it as a difficulty for him, and he was certainly of the view that he wasn't doing any public policy favours for these people. But I think instinctively one would... Yeah, and I think that's David's point, and you know, and the reviewers, and I think that's, you know, reasonable enough.
And I think you make the point in the book, because you should say that you've got unprecedented access to his papers, and yeah. So you're able to follow some correspondence around issues. And one point you make, I think, at one point is that the written communications, letters that are sent to him, when they touch on sensitive or potentially troublesome subjects, they go off the record. The conversation is continued either in person or over the phone or something, and there is no paper trail.
Yeah, and he often says, "Give me a ring," and the number is there. So, just on the archive, I mean, the Hawley family donated the archive to DCU. UCD were after it, Trinity were after it, you know, all sorts. He gave it to us in 2010. It took the library and the powers that be in the university some years to catalogue them, but they are catalogued, and we will now be releasing them in, I think, late February of 2022, 30 years after he leaves public office. I don't think we have the sort of ability or the capability to release them all in one tranche, so we will be releasing them slowly. And there will be a treasure trove for other historians and political scientists and people who are interested in the Irish state. And a question is often asked for me, are they pruned? And they might well be. All I do know is that the Haughey family gave us everything they had. There was some stuff certainly in his safe. I quote a letter, a memo from Haughey after a meeting with Vincent Brown when he's in the Department of Health. This is about the arms trial. And that was in his safe, so that wasn't part of the... It's not part of the papers. And certainly some of the correspondence says, let's talk about this, you know, give me a ring, or we can discuss this later on. And the paper trail does dissipate. There was a point in Alan Chatter's review about, I bet there wasn't very much on the negotiations with the revenue, and certainly there isn't. That is true. But we can only go on what we do have. It's a complicated story. The money trail is complicated, as those of us who have tried to follow it have. I thought, though, it was important to, in this book, to present his view of it as well, and his view and his family's view. And, you know, they have a website, I think, charityofhawley.ie, where they basically... disagree with the tribunal's findings and chart of how they did. But I thought it was important in a book where I tried to get into the sort of the thinking of Haughey to present that side of it. And I'm happy to for my critics to say that maybe I give him too much credit. So we can agree, I think, to disagree on that. I can agree to disagree with my critics, as my friend.
Yeah, of course. Yeah. Of course, yeah. Yeah. One last question on the money before we move on to the other issues. Yeah. And this is, I mean, the book is very much rooted in documentation and empirical evidence, and that's very important to say. But reading the stuff about the money, it does strike me there is a further question about the harm that might have been done by this kind of behaviour, which was that Charles Haughey did preside over probably the worst period of political corruption in the history of the state. And many of the people who were involved in that were his henchmen or his advisors, or were very politically close to him. Wasn't restricted to Fianna Fáil, but it was disproportionately present in Fianna Fáil. And the people suffered because of that corruption in all kinds of different ways. And the country suffered as a result of it. And you can sort of argue that can be traced back to the example given by Haughey.
It's very interesting in his papers. He makes this point that the Irish public wanted to see their leaders kind of live a certain type of lifestyle and didn't want, and there was talk about, you know, he didn't go ahead with the building of the Taoiseach's residence that Jack Lynch had mooted in the Phoenix Park. That clearly, I think, is, you know, way over the top. Because certainly the Irish people don't expect to see their Taoiseach living in such opulence as Haughey clearly did. And once the revelations came out, which he never thought would happen, he never thought that the imbroglio with between Margaret Heffernan and Ben Dunn would lead basically to his demise. I write critically of him there, where I think this is like short-sighted in the extreme to think that this would happen. But your point is I think well made. The idea that the Taoiseach of the country, and not just the Taoiseach, but before he was Taoiseach, when he was a minister, and remember he was a minister for justice, for agriculture, for finance, then for health before he becomes Taoiseach in 79, would receive large amounts of, well, not large amounts, millions, from private donors, certainly gives rise to the idea, well, that if it's okay for the Taoiseach to do it, or if it's okay for a senior politician to do it, well, it's okay for anyone else to do it. And I do think there is a stain on the Irish body politic that can be traced back to him. And I'm, you know, and although I have access to the papers and I got to know the Haughey family, I think that is a fair, it's a fair point.
I don't propose to go in detail into the intricacies of the arms trial, which could take several podcasts,
and
we could still do several more at that point. Yeah. But there's no doubt it's a pivotal turning point in the story of his life and his political career. And it turns him into a sort of an outsider figure, which, despite the social things we talked about earlier, he hadn't been up until then. He had been a rising star of the party, a minister for finance, as you say, a putative next leader. And all of a sudden he is cast out into the cold. And also something which I don't see in the book up until that point, he becomes part of a divide within Fianna Fáil around the question of how to deal with the violence in Northern Ireland, which has exploded at the end of the 1960s and will continue for the rest of his political career. So he almost becomes overnight a different kind of a figure and a different type of a politician. Would that be fair?
It would, completely. So, I mean, it's very interesting. So he becomes Minister for Finance after his difficulties with in agriculture, with the famous farmers' strike, which I describe in some detail. And when Lammas steps down and Jack Lynch takes over and how he is made Minister for Finance, he is not at the pinnacle, but very, very, very near it. And he's barely 40. So it's a meteoric rise in the 10 years from 57 to, let's say, 67. That decade is a great decade for him politically and publicly. And people do talk about him as potentially a successor to Lammas in 66. And as we know, he eventually does pull out of the contest between Lynch and Colley. And there's no evidence at all, really, of him having any either tremendous interest in Northern Ireland, and there's no anti-British evidence. There are, in fact, quite warm letters from him to politicians from both the Tories and Labour in the 1960s. And then once the North erupts, the whole thing changes completely, and it does change the second half of his life, because he is sacked by Lynch, he is arrested, he is brought to the Bridewell, and he is later charged, and he is put on trial. A point which I think has been missed, perhaps in the historiography up to now, is that what might have happened if he was found guilty? Well, he would have been sent to jail. I think the maximum sentence was something like 10 years. Now, it obviously would have depended on the judge, but for a man of 45 years of age, used to the lifestyle he was living then in 1970, you know, one couldn't imagine a greater fall. And, you know, there has been very good scholarship recently. A lot of people would know Michael Heaney's book, The Plot That Never Was, sort of a forensic examination, literally day by day over the course of those 2 years. I cover it in two chapters. I try to look at it from Haughey's perspective in relation to his defence. And I do try to figure out, as many others, including Heaney and David Burke, and pretty much anyone who's written about modern Irish history. And there is a view that Haughey lied through his teeth. Dermot Ferret and others have espoused that view. And then there is more recent scholarship, which again suggests that actually Lynch must have known. And David McCullough, who we mentioned earlier in his review, says the idea that Haughey famously hands-on minister wouldn't have known what was happening, kind of, you know, damns him. And I think all that is perhaps reasonable. The problem for Haughey, who said, you know, that he was, when these arms are coming in from Vienna, and Peter Berry puts a stop to it, and they have that disputed conversation on the phone, and Haughey said he didn't know what was in this cargo, but wanted the cargo to be let through, and that is the difficulty for him. And it's a very complex story, simply on the grounds, as Heaney and others have argued, because Lynch should have known, or probably did know, and that is the great debate. I cover it in two chapters in a long book, you know, because I'm doing Cradle to Grave, and I come down on the Heaney side of things for the most part. But I think what I kind of bring new is the thought process about his arrest, and the thought process about his defence. It's interesting. He is the only parliamentarian put on trial. One would have thought, even looking back now, I think, as a thing from one would have thought, the evidence against Blaney seems much stronger to me than the evidence against Haughey. And yet we know that Blaney was, the charges against him were dismissed by another court. And Haughey, the sort of the nouveau riche, the man who had made all these great strides in the 60s, is arrested, charged, and ultimately acquitted, as we know, by a jury of his peers.
Are you suggesting he was the fall guy?
I think I probably am, and I think I make that point in the book, that, and he certainly believed right until Lynch's death, and I write about probably going to that funeral in 1999 in Cork, that he thought that Lynch basically had knifed him in the back. There is again a disputed conversation when Haughey is in hospital after the fall from the horse, in and of itself disputed. And basically he's not sacked in his hospital bed, but he might as well have been. He was sacked just a week or two later when he was out. He's sacked over the phone by Lynch. And it is a very complex story, as we know. I think all those who sort of weigh into it do so with some trepidation, as I have. But yeah, I am sympathetic to what happened to him, I suppose, might be the most generous way of putting it.
Yeah, funny you mention him falling off the horse. One of the striking things about the book, which I hadn't realised, is that he's always crashing cars or falling off horses or almost drowning in his yacht. He has this series of catastrophes, which I suppose perhaps reflects the kind of risk-taking, he would say perhaps slightly buccaneering nature of his personality. But one thing in the wake of the arms trial I think is definitely true. If you agree that the measure of a man is how he deals with a serious setback, well, Haughey, just from a purely political, analytical point of view, is extremely impressive what he does, the way in which he rebuilds his career. He refuses to join the likes of Blaney and Boland by leaving the party or trying to set up another party, because he knows there is no future politically in Ireland for him with that. And he has to eat humble pie. He has to work and work and work and work again. And he works his way back, and he then proves himself to be the most adept political operator within the most adept political machine in the country.
Yeah.
And within a decade wins the leadership of the party.
Yeah, like, I mean, Haughey wanted to be Taoiseach. That's the first thing to be said. And he wanted to be Taoiseach from a very early age when he enters political life. He wasn't backbench fodder, or certainly didn't think of himself in those terms. And he knew, and there was a letter from Kevin Boland to him saying, you know, you must now join me in this great new movement, which he basically ignores. He has no interest in anything like independent Fianna Fáil with Neil Blaney. He knew that Fianna Fáil was the only vehicle. I mean, Fianna Fáil got routinely in the mid-40s in the elections in the 1960s. De Valera had gotten to 51.5% just a decade earlier. There's no future politically for any sort of independent party in 1970, and he knows. Now, he is clearly outsmarted, I think, by Lynch when he's forced to vote confidence in Jim Gibbons. Harry Boland says in the in the Mint Productions documentary of 15 years ago that was the lowest ebb for him, as Haughey's friend, that Haughey would vote confidence in Gibbons in the Dáil. Lynch basically said that anyone who didn't vote confidence was going to be turfed out of the parliamentary party, which would have posed difficulties for Haughey. Not quite, you know, not in the parliamentary party, but not out of Fianna Fáil. But if you're out of the parliamentary party, being out of the party was probably the next step open to the leadership there. And that was extraordinarily difficult for him. But I think this is where I put the idea of these kind of separate Haugheys. He just said, this is something I have to do. And then he starts, as we know, going on that famous chicken and chip circle, although I make the point he was insistent that he would have Dover sole. People do say it was steak, but really, PJ Mara told me before he sadly died, he taught me that, you know, fish was what Haughey basically, and a nice shabla, or shabla, so I'm not sure how to pronounce it. That was his favourite choice. And people were told in the hotels beforehand, you know, whatever about chicken or steak, Mr. Haughey will have to have fish. But they're long days. They go early. They drive off to Donegal and Cork. It's interesting. Haughey would never, ever have allowed something similar happened in his constituency. The idea that, you know, some sort of pariah would come in and give a speech in Artain, that certainly wouldn't have happened to him. But he was, you know, because there are divisions within Fianna Fáil. The cabinet rallies around Lynch, as we know, and the party, for the most part, rallies around Lynch after the arms crisis. We know when he comes back from the United States, there's a great cadre of politicians to meet him in 1970 after Haughey is acquitted, and Haughey calls rather impulsively for Lynch to consider his position. But the 70s the roads are sort of long and windy. He did make it his business, though, that he would never be away from Abbeville or from home on two successive weekend nights. So if he was in the country on Friday night, he wouldn't be there on Saturday night. Or vice versa. That's just an interesting point in and of itself, I think, about how he sort of lived his life.
So he works his way back onto the opposition front bench of Fianna Fáil in 75, and then back into government as Minister for Health in 77, and then completely outmaneuvers his opponents within Fianna Fáil when Jack Lynch suddenly decides to resign, thinking, I think Lynch thinks that by doing so he is preventing Haughey succeeding him. Little does he know that Haughey has his number.
Yeah, I mean, it's an interesting episode of high politics, I suppose. The common story is of Haughey bullying and cajoling backbenchers. I tend to follow, actually, the Vincent Brown, when he, in his great piece of journalism a couple of decades ago about how he came to power. I think that's very accurate. 4 decades later, reading it, it reads extraordinarily fresh. Lynch went early in December 1979 in the hope, strong hope and expectation that Colley would win a leadership election against Haughey. Haughey was cultivating the 1977 backbenchers, though, with the exception of Martin O'Donoghue. Pretty much every other backbencher who was elected, and Fianna Fáil had this great win on the back of the famous manifesto, the sort of beginning, one might say, of auction politics, abolition of rates, car tax, and the like. Northern Ireland, amazingly, in that manifesto, reduced to half a page, the very last page, and, you know, some typically bland statement. But Haughey is meeting with them. He knows all of them. He knows who they are. There's a famous story Bertie Ahern tells about Lynch passing him and, you know, basically barely saying hello to him, not knowing who he was. Haughey knew who all the backbenchers were, and he was cultivating them. But he did not expect the leadership election to take place as it did. And, you know, it's a two-day campaign. I mean, it's quite extraordinary. In one way, Lynch goes on the 5th, and the election is held on the 7th of December. And Haughey then is made Taoiseach on the 11th of December with all those speeches about what a terrible character he was, from Gareth Fitzgerald and Frank Kluskey and Noel Brown and others. But he...
that flawed pedigree statement by Fitzgerald. Fitzgerald said that he had a flawed pedigree in the speeches on the when Haughey was being elected. That's often been characterised as snobbery. Gareth Fitzgerald says it was a mistake and regretted it afterwards. It had a certain ring of snobbery to it all the same, didn't it?
Yeah. So in Gareth Fitzgerald's autobiography, All in a Life, written three decades ago, 1991, I think, he puts it to the late hour, and that it was a rhetorical flourish, and it was to do with the party's pedigree in Fianna Fáil, that half of the party had no faith in him and had voted against him. Well, just under half. I mean, he wins the vote 44 to 38 of the 82 people who were eligible to vote in that Fianna Fáil leadership election in December. But yeah, I mean, looking at it now, and I try to look at it with some with a sort of detached eye. You know, I come, as I said earlier, from the sort of inner city, although from a different city. So I was very conscious of the fact that I might have had my own biases here, and which I didn't want to be unfair to Fitzgerald. But looking at it, it's very difficult to see it in any other way. It certainly, Owen Haughey, 40 years afterwards, when I met him in 2014, 35 years after, whenever, he and his mother were clearly very put out. That basically a son of privilege of the sort of revolutionary elite, Gareth Fitzgerald, would say that of both their brother and son. And, you know, as we started out this conversation, Hugh, he did have a difficult upbringing. And Haughey never forgot it. He held it against Fitzgerald. Now, their correspondence, I quote a very friendly letter from them, you know, just before Haughey dies, about a conversation they had when Fitzgerald came out to Abbeville as Haughey was in his latter stages. But it did, I'm not sure if poison is the right word, but it certainly coloured Haughey's view of Fitzgerald right throughout their great battles in the 1980s. And I don't think it's too strong to say that, you know, Haughey's often criticised for opposing everything in the 1980s. Divorce subliminally. He doesn't say in the Dáil that people should vote no, but, you know, you'd only have to listen to any of his speeches at the time. Certainly the Anglo-Irish Agreement of the previous year, which I'm critical of Haughey's approach to economics. But I think a lot of it can certainly be traced back to a personal dislike that probably went before. Now, in the 1960s, Haughey writes to Fitzgerald saying he's very disappointed that Fitzgerald is joining Fine Gael. He had tried to poach him into Fianna Fáil, I think, with Gareth Fitzgerald's heritage. That was never going to happen, although he does admit, as you know, for voting for Le Mas, I think, in 65. But yeah, it did. It certainly was a difficult day for Haughey. He sat there, sort of basilisk-like in the Dáil, as he was accused of being a bit like Salazar, Richard Nixon. I think that was what Noel Brown said. Frank Klusky implored Fianna Fáil voters not to vote for him. But yeah, I mean, I think it does reek of a certain class elitism.
Yeah, I'm not, because time will prevent us from getting into, much as I would like to, the details of that first Haughey government, and then the loss at the election, and then the return of a second brief Haughey government. Beyond saying that, I mean, you mentioned earlier that he was intent set from very early on achieving the office of Taoiseach. And perhaps, as sometimes happens in those situations, he didn't quite seem to know exactly what to do with it when he got there. And then there are a combination of things. Some of them are just terrible bad luck, like the Stardust fire, which happened in his constituency, but which also affected the timing of when he was able to go to the country. Then you obviously had the hunger strikes bubbling up in Northern Ireland. So he was unlucky politically in those regards, but he was also, he made some very bad decisions, both in terms of economic management, and in the second of those governments, appointing Sean Doherty and others, who ended up being disastrous and led to the famous Gubu years and cast him into opposition. And then in the 80s, this is the part that I remember as a living person, I suppose, so I'm kind of more, not more exercised about it, but anyway, it impacted upon me more. The 80s were terrible in Ireland.
Oh, terrible.
And some of it wasn't Haughey's fault, but some of it was,
yeah.
You know, and the way in which he played the issues about things like the social issues for partisan advantage certainly didn't make it any better. And his contribution to the economic situation certainly wasn't very positive, certainly in the first half of the decade. So really, you know, he did us all no favours.
Yeah, so, I mean, and a lot of people obviously talk about the famous speech he makes just a couple of weeks after becoming Taoiseach about tightening our belts when he clearly wasn't tightening his, as we know now. But one of the difficulties was that the party was divided. He could have made a very grand statement and not appointed George Colley when Colley didn't... Now this is a complicated story because Haughey says that Colley swore loyalty to him after the December election, and then Colley said no, he didn't. But he brings Colley and Des O'Malley, and maybe he couldn't have left them outside cabinet. But his cabinet is divided, and the party is divided, and O'Malley and Colley adamantly refused to have any cuts in their own departmental budgets. So in industry and commerce. And the issue there is that Jan Haughey kind of funks the hard decision, certainly. And then he makes some of these very odd gestures in relation to settling issues, including giving teachers and hospital consultants far more than what they were actually looking for to settle disputes, which again impacted significantly on the public purse, and also impacted on, you know, those who relied, as they saw it, on Haughey and on Fianna Fáil to look after social welfare measures. Any increases in social welfare are wiped out by increases in inflation. Haughey is not as obsessed about inflation as Margaret Thatcher is in Britain. But his constituents were not well served then. And you're right about the 1980s. I was in secondary school, and then later I went to UCC. Later there was nothing else to do. They were miserable. The divorce and the abortion referendum of 1983 is even worse. Now, I think Ara Fitzgerald holds grave responsibility as much as Haughey for kowtowing to the pro-life amendment campaign people, and I write about that. Divorce certainly is, one way Haughey understands the Fianna Fáil electorate, and the Fianna Fáil electorate wasn't in favour of divorce for the most part. Certainly the rural parts of it were not. There were certain liberals, people like Seamus Brennan and others in Fianna Fáil. And he does kind of play a double game there in 86. Let's put it like this. He certainly wasn't unhappy when the divorce referendum wasn't passed, because it was another failure for Fitzgerald. And then when the election comes in 1987, after the Fine Gael Labour coalition sort of implodes and Labour leads, he's primed for leadership. The Anglo-Irish Agreement doesn't feature in the election. That's an election about the economy, who can get Ireland out of the mess. But he is denied again the overall majority. Why is he denied the overall majority? Because the PDs do so well. And why do the PDs do so well? Well, that's a question that Haughey had to face up to, because the Des O'Malley being expelled from the party, he certainly had a very fair wind behind him and did much better than he and certainly Haughey expected in 87.
Yeah, so he arrives in 87, and I do remember this. He makes a bunch of promises in the election and then completely does a volte-face on them when he gets into power, which, you know, is not an unknown in politics. And this is the period that in your book, I think, and generally in retrospect, as seen as certainly his most significant and important impact on Irish society, really, in terms of setting the template, really, for the economic recovery of the 1990s and beyond. I do wonder, looking at that, whether, no matter what his efforts were to get the overall majority he craved, he was a better politician when he was constrained either by something like the Fine Gael's Talla Agreement support, or then after 1989 by coalition, that there was somebody keeping an eye on him, I suppose.
Yeah, I think there's something to that. But I also don't think it should be sort of oversold. By 87, Haughey is 62. Probably knows that he has one full government, maybe two. Is very disappointed not to get the overall majority in 87. and is lucky that Alan Jukes did what probably Hawke wouldn't have done, which is to support the general macroeconomic thrust, which was to cut public spending and to regain international confidence in the Irish state. And because, as you said, you know, the Irish economy was a basket case in the 1980s, and we had emigration levels that we hadn't been seen since the 1950s, and lots of people thought that you know, Ireland wasn't a state with much of a future, including, I suspect, some of our contemporaries, Hugh. But when he works social partnership, and social partnership is interesting because that's about the state. That's about the power of the state, the power of the state to bring farmers, trade unions, and the business communities together. I mean, he ditches the ICMSA, the small farming organisation, when they say they can't sign up to it. He said, well, off you go. We're going ahead with this anyway. He made similar threats to the unions and to IBEC, and both of them signed up for it. And, you know, social partnership has its critics because it fails basically in 2008 when the economic crash happens. But it gave the Irish state, I think, two decades of relatively macroeconomic stability. But then he is also, you know, he's then pushing for the IFSC. He's pushing for private industry to, you know, he goes to Japan. I mean, there's all the talk about Japan and the famous calling of the 89 election. But the reason he's there is he's trying to drum up business for the Irish state. The IDA are very happy with Hawke because he goes to the United States, he goes to Japan, trying to drum up business and say Ireland is a place you can, you as in the Royal, you can invest your money in. And it works. It works for the most part. I mean, again, it's difficult if you're poor. But the opportunities do begin to emerge in the late 80s that certainly weren't there in 5 or 6 years earlier during the Fine Gael Labour coalition.
Although it's not entirely down to him, in that the world around him is changing, and you have, you know, greater European unification, which offers opportunities, and then, you know, as you get into the 1990s, increased globalisation, which Ireland benefits from. So there are broader factors at play.
Oh, no, very much so, yeah. No, I wouldn't want to claim, and I don't think I claim in the book, that Hawke is the sole agent, but he is the agent that macroeconomic policy revolves around, and he uses the office of the Taoiseach much more strongly than any previous incumbent had in trying to drive economic policy. But, and he does this with Ray McSharry, and McSharry was deeply worried. I write, there's an anecdote in the book about Pádraig Flynn saying at the first cabinet meeting in 87, you know, that the natives basically won't wear the cutbacks, and McSharry having his hand in his mouth, basically, that Hawke would say, well, Ray, we have to rethink it. But no, because McSharry told him, I will become Minister of Finance as long as you back me. And Hawke did back him, and he told Flynn and others, if you don't like it, get out of the room and we'll just get other people. And Fianna Fáil was, for the first time since Hawke became leader in 79, once the O'Malley Lee is expelled, and there's obviously a debate in the party about that, and once the party is relatively united, it works for them. And then, of course, it all goes spectacularly pear-shaped in early 1992 when the ghost of Sean Doherty come back to haunt him. And you're certainly right there, and I make no qualms about this in the book. Appointing Sean Doherty in 1982 was a disastrous error of judgment by Hawke to the Ministry of Justice. Guards, former guards, shouldn't be in charge of the guards, I think, in the first instance. And Hawke, you know, I write at length on that chapter, I think it's called Phone Tapping, about Hawke's defence. And, you know, there's a copy of the Irish Times of the day with all his little annotations in his papers. But again, a bit like the money, he leaves himself wide open to the fact that he must have known about the phone tapping because of the person he appointed in the first place. And, you know, many people told me off the record, and I have to remain off the record for our conversation, that how he must have known, because, again, he was sort of, he wanted to know what was going on in all of his departments. But his defence always was that, you know, Doherty had let him down. It's written brilliantly about in the Murtagh and Joyce book, The Boss, which still remains fresh to this day, and another famous Irish Times journalist. But it's Hawke hated that book, by the way. Peter, I think, will enjoy that, but he wouldn't have it mentioned in his in his company. But again, the problem for him was that, he was just left out by a mistake he had made a decade earlier. And he certainly should have known better than to appoint Sean Doherty to such a crucial position.
And in a way, isn't it true as well that the baggage of his past would have prevented him from progressing what became the peace process in the 1990s under Albert Reynolds and particularly under Albert Reynolds and Bertie Ahern, in that it would have been more... He did reach out. There were initial talks with Republicans in Northern Ireland, but it would have been much more difficult to go much further with that, with Haughey in power, than it was with Reynolds.
Yeah, I think I write in the book something along the lines that the ghost of the arms triangle always stayed with Haughey, and that was certainly true in relation to the burgeoning peace process from 1987 onwards, when Alec Reid visited Kinsealy as an intermediary with Sinn Féin. There are letters to and from, Gerry Adams, looking for what became a type, what was later the kind of pan-nationalist front. Haughey certainly couldn't have any of this become public, because I think the reaction still would have been extraordinarily hostile, and perhaps rightly so. I mean, he was deeply, deeply shocked. So shocked as to be practically speechless by Enniskillen in November of 87. I mean, the feelers had been put out about peace, and yet you had this just heinous crime committed by the provos, which definitely, you know, rocked him on his heels, and rocked the belief, I think, of many who were working for peace that the provos were serious about it. Because if you're serious about it, you know, you don't go targeting the most sacred day in the sort of in the unionist tradition, whether we like it or not. And I think that's what Enniskillen represented to Haughey. He kind of sticks with it over the course of the next few years. There are relatively harmonious relations in the early stages with John Major, but then they go rapidly downhill. And I think I write in the book that it's by January, February 92, when he goes, the peace process is in a kind of stalemate. And it does take Albert Reynolds over the course of the following year and a half to come up, or 2 years, to drive forward with the Downing Street Declaration, which I don't think Haughey would have been able to get over the line like Albert was.
And then he does depart relatively quietly in the end. And then there's, as you've mentioned earlier, this kind of rather dismal coda of the tribunals, which are humiliating for him, perhaps justifiably. Just looking now back, maybe to go back to where we started at the top of this conversation, now that we're 30 years on from Haughey being Taoiseach, I look at him. This is a very 2021 question. There are elements of Haughey's political persona that resonate today when people talk about the populist political style, that the kind of the idea of the strong leader, and perhaps the wealthy leader who also paradoxically is against the elites, and various other elements of the Haughey style and appeal to nationalism, perhaps to some extent as well. I don't necessarily mean these in a pejorative way, although some might see them that way. You can sort of see in him a forerunner of some of the populist styles that we've seen in the last 10 years in other countries. But he stands alone and unique among Irish political leaders in having that kind of political style.
I would agree with that. I mean, comparisons are made with people like Berlusconi in Italy, and later, I think, Donald Trump in the United States. And certainly Haughey had a kind of a great man view of history himself. I mean, he did have the idea that history could be shaped by great men like him. This is thinking now in sort of Haughey's persona, as distinct from what I think, but he certainly did think that, and that he could shape political events. And he was then himself, you know, paradoxically outmaneuvered by Albert Reynolds in January of 1992, and forced out of office much earlier than he certainly wanted to go. But you know, I write in the I think in the towards the end of the book about there's a whole about sort of maybe a life one parallel. And what I meant by that was to say, if you think then we haven't talked about the Terry Keane sex stuff, which is fine, but there's the sort of the extramarital affair. There is the huge money. There's the big house. There are the grand gestures. But there's also significant public policy positives, I think, which we've just talked about, you know, certainly in the economy, in the early stages of the peace process. In Ireland, on the international stage, I mean, Haughey clearly runs a very successful European presidency, and he, in his sort of, when he's trying to defend, when he's thinking about writing his memoir, Martha Mansour and other people kind of help him, and it goes nowhere. But he talks about people around the table at that stage. He mentions Andriotti, he mentions Papandreou, he mentions Mitterrand. He saw himself as, you know, the personification, I suppose one might put it, of the Irish great man being able to do things and sitting comfortably at this table with Thatcher and with the greats of Helmut Kohl and the greats of European diplomacy. And that is a successful presidency. I mean, obviously the early stages of German unification are being discussed. He travels all around Europe. But but the point is that he certainly thought of himself in those grand gestures. And maybe I think politics anymore doesn't allow for that kind of grand gesture to be made. He certainly had, and I write about this in the book, a difficult relationship with some civil servants who wanted to observe a far more incremental style, let's put it like that, maybe a presidential style, Hugh, and certainly how he had difficulties with President Hillary and President Robinson, those two who he would have dealt it. And that's why I think I mention it as a kind of a life unparalleled in the modern Irish set. No, and you know, he would be horrified at where Fianna Fáil is. Where Fianna Fáil is now, I mean, he probably is turning in that grave in Sutton, because he, you know, I think to see Fianna Fáil at, you know, whatever it is, 13-14% in the polls, he certainly wouldn't be able to, because he saw Fianna Fáil as many did, Sean Lamass did, to go back to Eamon De Valera, as the vehicle for social, economic, even cultural progress. And culture, I know we haven't touched on it, but again, is a big part of his of how he saw himself, but also of how he saw Ireland. I mean, he became a collector of all sorts of things, as we know, very valuable paintings. And again, this goes back to the money, how were these paid for? But he did become a collector of, you know, Louis Le Brocchi's. I quote a letter from Le Brocchi to him where he delivers some watercolours. And people, you would know much more about than I would. But it is, it's sort of bound up in this extraordinary life, I would say.
Yeah, I actually did want to just briefly touch on that arts and culture thing, because he is. I mean, he's absolutely head and shoulders above any other significant Irish political figure, you know, at the senior government level, in terms of his engagement with Irish culture and Irish artists and certain things he did as well. And his friendships with everybody from, you know, McLearmore and Edwards to the great visual artists and poets. And he knew what he was talking about. He wasn't spoofing either. But yet there's something about that I still wonder about, and in a way that makes him a quintessential Irish politician in some ways. And I think you refer to this in the book, that he saw his role as getting things for people and bypassing a faceless and unsympathetic bureaucracy that wouldn't necessarily get them. The whole idea of the Irish politician as the deliverer of the goodies to the people who deserve the goodies, which has always been there, it seems to me, in Irish politics, and hasn't entirely gone away, you know? So that the criticism, I suppose, would be that despite his own personal experiences, he always thought that the party and the state could be intertwined in a way, as opposed to necessarily, some might say, changing the structures of the state to eliminate inequality.
Yeah, I mean, to quote two other famous Irish Times journalists, there's a famous piece with Nuala O'Fallon in the Irish Times from, I think, 89, where he does talk about the faceless bureaucracy and him overcoming that, and that the people shouldn't be unaware that it was he was responsible for them getting it, or Fianna Fáil. And you know, just to fast forward a bit, in 2011, many people in Fianna Fáil thought that they would be saved from an unmerciful crushing at the electorate's hands by that sort of patronage that had been built up over decades. Now, we know that didn't happen because the sort of economic crash took precedence over everything else. But it was, I remember talking to Fianna Fáil people at the time who said they didn't see the scale of it, notwithstanding what opinion polls were telling them. And then to quote maybe perhaps Fintan O'Toole, who was very sceptical about Haughey's relationship with the arts, seeing it again perhaps as a vehicle for both personal and political advancement. And I think that's not being unfair to Fintan, who writes, I think, quite brilliantly, although I wasn't in time to engage with it in his recent brilliant book, because I was my own was gone to my long suffering publishers by then. But certainly the Haughey with and I think this is what I write at the beginning when I say there's loads of different Haugheys. He was interested in art. He did understand it, and he made it his business to understand it and to talk to people about it. I mean, he was interested in wine, and he had quite a significant wine cellar with the, you know, quite significantly good wines in it. And then he was interested in things like you know, he had a beehive in Abbeville, and he cultivated, you know, various botanists about his gardens. And some people have seen a sort of a kind of Haughey getting above his kind of station, perhaps, to go back to the class thing. You know, and there's the famous painting of him with the bowl of heart, the Maguire painting, or maybe lampooning. He was impervious to being lampooned for the most part. I mean, he didn't like Scrap Saturday, but you know, he wasn't going to sue or anything like that either. He came close, I think, to suing Sebastian Barry and the Abbey, if not close. I mean, his solicitors certainly were very upset about the staging of that, and you know, wrote a solicitor's letter to the Abbey, but he put a stop to that himself as well, which. And again, isn't there a discussion about that, which we probably don't have time to, about why Haughey didn't sue various places, because he didn't want, perhaps, people trawling through his finances or anything else.
The example of Oscar Wilde might have struck in relation to that. Do you feel you know him now, having spent so much time with him and with his papers? Because he still seems somewhat unknowable to me.
Yeah, I know him better now than I did, and I mean, I know there are people who knew him. I never met him. I know there are people who knew him and would think they would know him better than anybody else. And I know people like Vincent Brown would know him very well, who are, you know, still thinking about him all the time. Matt Cooper and others. I think I know as much about him as pretty much anybody else, I think. I know the papers. The papers are extraordinary because they're not just about the great and the good. They're not just about Thatcher and Mitterrand and, you know, Fianna Fáil. They're about ordinary people on the north side writing to him, trying to better themselves. There are some, what I would describe as painful letters. They're painful to read because of the poverty that is on display in them. And that's why I describe them. I think they will be a treasure trove. And yeah, he is unknowable in one way. I mean, I write at the end in Myths and Contradictions. I mean, he was a contradictory character. Certainly, and there were kinks in there that I haven't figured out, and I don't think others would. But I think, says he modestly, that I maybe know him as much as probably anyone could know him, which maybe isn't enough, but it's the best I can do.
Haughey is published by Gill Books, and it's the perfect present for Christmas for the Irish political nerd in your life. Thanks to Gary for joining us. Thanks also to our producer, Jennifer Ryan. We will be back very soon, but do remember you can mail us with your thoughts and your questions at politicspodcast@irishtimes.com. So until then, see you soon.
Thank you, Hugh.
The Irish Times Inside Politics podcast is taken to the road this year with a series of podcasts in front of live audiences. The first is on April the 10th in the Mac in Belfast, when we're going to be discussing the impact of the year of elections on politics across the island of Ireland. We would love to see you there and hear what you have to say too. So to book, go to events.irishtimes.com. That's events.irishtimes.com.